Jamie was working alone in the fields about a mile from their cabin, breaking new ground that he and Wells and Moses had spent all winter clearing of timber. Moses was several miles away, as was Wells, each working on their own land. Jamie was a grown man, and he had matured into the height and heft to match his adulthood. He stood well over 6 feet, and his arms and shoulders were packed with muscle. His hands were huge and his wrists thick. Moses had opined to his son-in-law that Jamie was a man he would not like to see angered. Truthfully, Jamie didn't know his own strength, but like so many big, powerful men, he was surprisingly gentle. Jamie had heard from the Indians that white slave hunters were working up north, and that some escaped slaves and families had been recaptured and sent back across the Sabine River to go on the auction block. But there had been no reports of any slavers working in this area.
Ho!
The shot came from the direction of Jamie's cabin. Jamie jerked the carbine from the boot on the plow. He carried pistol, powder horn, and shot pouch on him and went racing on foot toward the cabin.
God damn, you got fire! Help!
At the cabin, Kate had downed one slaver with a rifle and was desperately fighting with another as men were ransacking the cabin and others attempting to free the horses from the corral in back of the cabin. The burly man Kate was struggling with ripped her dress from throat to waist and stood for a moment, licking his lips at the side of her full, bare breast. He reached out with a dirty hand to caress her breast, and Kate gave him a knee in the groin and the man went down. Kate kicked him in the face and grabbed up a pistol just as another slaver leaped into the open doorway. Kate shot him in the chest. One of the slavers in the home grabbed up baby Karen from the cradle and grinned at Kate.
You shook out of that there dress, or the baby gets his brains bashed out.
I got it. Yeah, I got you now.
Another man grabbed her from behind and pulled up her dress, shoving his hand between her legs and fondling her. A bearded man came out of the bedroom where he'd been unsuccessful in his attempts to find jewelry or gold.
Kill that kid and take the bitch with us.
The man holding Karen threw the child on the floor and stomped on her head. Kate broke free, whirled around, and dragged her fingernails across the eyes and face of her assailant. Jamie came running onto the scene. He dropped to one knee and leveled his rifle, knocking a man off a horse. Moses and Wells galloped to within rifle range. Two more of the bounty hunting slavers were down in the dirt, both of them belly shot. Jamie saw the leader of the band, the man who had ordered the death of Karen, bolt out the cabin door. Jamie and Moses fired as one, the heavy caliber ball striking the man in the belly and chest. He fell backwards, his boots on the ground and his upper body inside the cabin.
Let's get out of here!
The others panicked and took off at full gallop. Jamie made no effort of pursuit. He ran into the cabin and stood in numb shock for a moment. Kate was on her knees over the still body of baby Karen, blood and brains under the child's head.
That bitch tried to blind me!
Jamie drove the butt of his rifle into the man's belly, knocking him to the floor. Moses and Wells entered the cabin.
You two drag this bastard out of here. You hog time, and don't kill him. I need to talk to him. Wells, ride for Liza and Sally.
Jamie knew there was nothing he could do for baby Karen. He quickly checked the other children, saw that they were uninjured.
It's okay now. You run outside. Moses is out there. Go on.
Jamie turned his attention to Kate.
Kate. Come on, Kate.
No! My baby! She needs me! No!
Kate, don't!
Jamie had to fight Kate away from the dead baby. She hammered at him with her fists. He finally pinned her to the floor, where she mercifully fainted. He held her until Liza and Sally arrived, and they moved her to the bed. Jamie wrapped up the baby in a blanket and laid her on a floor pallet. Moses and his boys joined Jamie in the cabin.
Jed, fetch a shovel. Go to the cemetery and start digging.
How many of them gone away?
About 10 or so, I reckon.
Jamie looked in on Kate. She was unconscious on the bed, Liza and Sally placing cool, damp cloths on her face. Jamie went outside to the hog-tied man and stood for a moment, looking down at him.
I ain't telling you nothing, bastard.
You'll tell me everything I want to know.
Hey, goddammit, what are you doing?
Jamie reached down and grabbed the man's shirt front and dragged him bodily to the barn. Jamie pulled his skinning knife from leather and walked toward the man.
Say now, I'm a white man. You can't do this to me.
Jamie dragged the bloody body into the swamps, threw the carcass into the black water. The gators would find the body and stuff it up under cypress roots to ripen before they feasted. From a canoe, two Indians watched the tall and muscular young man walk back toward his cabin. The Indians swiftly paddled away. The man who was not afraid had a terrible expression on his face. Before he died, the slaver had told him all the names of those in the gang. They were as firmly in place in his mind as if they'd been carved in stone. Jamie cleaned the gore off of him and walked into the cabin. Kate was awake and sitting in a chair looking at the blanket-wrapped body of Karen. She'd lost the wild look in her eyes. She looked up at Jamie.
Who were they?
Part of the Newby Brothers gang. Waymore's leading this bunch, but he wasn't along. They're camped just north of Nacogdoches.
You'll be going after them?
Just as soon as we bury baby Karen.
Kate put her hands to her face for a moment. Then she lowered her hands and nodded her head and rose from the chair.
Let me get the Bible.
Another soul was committed tearfully to the ground in the small cemetery. An hour later, as the noonday sun beat down upon them, Jamie kissed Kate and held her for a moment.
They have to know that they cannot be allowed free license to torment us. They must learn that for every raid against us, I will kill 10 or more of them. Do you understand why I have to go, Kate?
I understand.
I'll return, Kate. When is something I can't tell you. I'll be back when you see me ride up to the cabin.
Kate touched his face with gentle fingers.
Put your supper in the saddlebags. I put your coat behind the saddle. The knots are still cool. I love you, Jamie Ian McAllister.
I love you, Kate.
He kissed her again, then stepped away into the saddle. Moses walked up to Kate.
It's gonna be a bloody time. Bloody days of retribution.
Kate turned and stared at the cemetery for a moment, just visible from the cabin. Then she looked at Moses, her eyes flashing blue fire.
I hope so, Moses.
Jamie rode to the settlement of Nacogdoches, which at this time boasted about 800 residents. Throughout the territory, there were some 16,000 Americans living, nearly four times that of the Mexican population. Jamie left his horse at a livery and walked into the general store, which was owned by a German immigrant named Adolphus Stern, who would be elected mayor of Nacogdoches in 1833. He carried his short-barreled carbine and two pistols stuck behind his wide belt. He was dressed in buckskins. With his long, flowing yellow hair, his tall stature, and his magnificent build, Jamie caused many a female heart to flutter that day. Stern himself was behind the counter, and he looked up instantly as Jamie approached him. Every customer in the huge store paused to stare at the tall and striking-looking young man.
You have an undertaker and preacher in this town?
Well, yes, we do. Would you like me to direct you to them?
No. But if you've got law in this settlement, warn them to stay out of my affairs. You've got 10 men camped just outside of town. They were part of the gang who attacked my farm east of here and tried to rape my wife. They killed my 5-month-old baby daughter. I intend to kill them all. And I intend to start with that man right over there.
The man had been inching toward the door as soon as Jamie had walked in. He cleared his pistol just as Jamie reached him. Jamie broke the man's arm at the elbow as easily as snapping a dry twig. No one in the store had moved to aid the man, all believing the young man's story. They stood rooted, eyes on the deadly scene being played out before him. Jamie drew a pistol and cocked it, placing the muzzle against the man's forehead.
I didn't touch your wife, and I wasn't in that cabin when the baby was killed, mister.
But you were there.
Yes, I was. We was looking for runaway slaves.
Jamie's eyes lit on a Cherokee standing impassively between a Cracker Barrel and a pickle barrel.
You know Egg?
Yes.
Will you take this man to him for punishment?
I will take. If you wish to wait, I will tell our men to assist you in this venture.
I don't need or want help.
I understand. A warrior must do what a warrior must do. May your medicine be strong, man who is not afraid.
Jamie nodded his head and walked out of the store.
You know that man, Paul?
All Indians know of him. Man who is not afraid. Man who plays with panthers and wolves. Jamie Ian McAllister.
Oh my God! The highwayman and murderer?
He is neither of those. He is a good, decent man who wishes only to farm the land, raise his family, and be left alone. Chief Diwali received a full report on Man Who Is Not Afraid years ago.
Stern had heard of Jamie, too. Smith and Fontaine had written to him. He could see now why they were so impressed by him. No one noticed Jamie leave town on foot, jogging his way north. He'd left his horse at the livery with orders to care and feed it, and taken his rifle and pistols, a bow, a quiver of arrows, and a bedroll. The slavers, bounty hunters, and all-around riffraff were camped only a few miles outside of the settlement, along the banks of a small creek. Jamie had hardly broken a sweat when he spotted the smoke from the cook fires drifting lazily up into the air. He cut off the road and into the timber, finding and following a centuries-old Indian trail. His moccasins made no sound as he drew closer to the gang of brigands, most of them playing cards. He was a warrior of the Shawnee Nation with but one thought on his mind. Revenge. Jamie worked his way around to the picket line and mingled among the horses, petting them. They were fine mounts, too. He'd take them with him when his mission was concluded, and all their supplies as well. A gang member left the campfire and walked toward the horses. A heartbeat later, he was dead. His throat cut from one side of his neck to the other. Jamie scalped him, his face expressionless, his eyes blue ice. Another gang member left the clearing to relieve himself. Jamie notched an arrow. The arrow from the powerful bow drove deep into his chest, piercing the heart. The man dropped soundlessly. Jamie would take his scalp later. With the man at the general store, that made 3 down, 7 to go.
Where the hell did Will go? Will! Will!
Jamie waited, an arrow notched and ready to fly. The man stood up. Jamie studied him closely. He vividly recalled the events in that trading post not far from the Mississippi River. Hard to believe it was only a few quick years past. It seemed like ages. This one was a newbie. Waymore newbie had turned just in time to save his life. The arrow pinned his wrist to his hip, sinking deep. Jamie dropped his bow and jerked out his pistols, letting the double-shotted balls fly. He dropped his pistols and grabbed up his rifle, shooting the slaver in the belly. Through the gun smoke, he could see the ground littered and bloodied with 4 bodies. 2 were still. The other 2 men were jerking and twitching in pain. But a Waymore newbie was not among them. Jamie shifted locations and quickly reloaded rifle and pistols.
Waymore! Where you is, man?
Oh, hurt! Goddamn air, it pinned my hand to my hip! Head's in deep, too! Grinding again my hip bone!
If it's Indians, how come they don't come on and finish it?
It ain't the Redskins! It's that goddamn Jamie McAllister!
McAllister? That can't be!
Yeah, it is! Soon as y'all told me about that yellow-haired girl, I knowed it had to be. He's out there, waiting. Get him, boys. You can't afford to let him live. He'll track us all to the edge of the hellfire.
As long as Jamie didn't move, they seemed unable to spot him.
Damn it, man. He's a ghost in them woods.
Oh, settle down, Bart. Just settle down. He ain't nothing but a snot-nosed kid who got lucky, that's all.
Oh, shit. It's Wilson. He's been scalped.
McAllister was raised up by them damn Shawnees, remember? He's a savage like them. Oh, God damn Jesus. I heard something fierce.
Jamie worked his way around the edge of the clearing, slipping along the creek bank, knowing the bank would conceal him. He slipped on a few yards and crawled up over the lip of the bank, coming up silently behind the crouching man. Jamie cut the man's throat and took his hair.
Osgood? You all right, Oz? Waymar, you say where Osgood jumped to when the shooting started?
Oh, over by the edge of the creek, I think.
Jamie threw back his head. Waymore and Bart filled the air with lead balls. Jamie leapt to the side, crawled the length of the cottonwoods, and slipped into the brush.
Oh, damn, that hurt. I broke the area off and freed my hand, but the point's still laying against my hip bone and scraping when I move. Work your way toward me, Barton. We'll have a better chance of staying alive if we're together.
Coming over.
He didn't make it. Jamie drilled him clean.
Just you and me now, newbie.
Damn you, McAllister. You killed my brothers.
They started it, newbie. You should have left it alone and stayed away from men like Olmsted and Jackson.
Let's deal, McAllister.
You have no bargaining position, newbie.
I got gold.
I don't want gold.
Waymore. Waymore.
By Jamie's calculations, there should only be Waymore left. Then he looked over at the small and bloody clearing. Where there had been four men lying around the fire, now there were only three.
That you, Smathers?
Yeah, I'm done for. But I got four loaded pistols and two rifles. Make for the horses and get gone from here. I'll hold McAllister for a spell.
You're a better man than all the rest put together, Smathers. I'll tell your kin how you died, and on the next run, they'll be along.
Get gone, Waymore. I can't last much longer.
To get to the picket line, Jamie would have to cross several barren spots. He wasn't going to risk it.
You can relax, Smathers. I'll stay here and talk to you while you got breath.
You show yourself, and I'll shoot you, McAllister.
I know it. Why'd you get tied up with a bastard like Newbie?
Money? Hard cash is tough to come by now. I wanted enough to buy me a piece of ground. I done had it cultivated. It's going for $1 an acre. Good bottom land, too. Had me a good gal, and we was betrothed.
You'd have been better off settling for less land.
Don't I know it now? You gonna take my hair, McAllister?
No. And I'll give you a decent burial.
Kind of you. I want you to know that I didn't have no idea the men was gonna try to molest no good woman. I never would have took no part in nothing like that. I never even come onto your land. I was a lookout about a mile up the trail.
All right, Smathers. Will your brothers come after me?
Yeah, they'll come. They're fools if they do, but I reckon they will. McAllister, how come you let me bluff you? I wanted you to shoot that damn Waymore. I ain't even got no gun.
You sure had me fooled, Smathers.
Looky here. I'm holding a flower in my hand so as you'll know who I am and won't scalp me. Oh, yeah. Them horses we're riding, they ain't stole. The bay... With the stocking feet is mine. He's a good'un. They's all good. You can have...
Jamie waited for a time, then worked his way around the camp, taking hair as he went. He buried Smathers. The other bodies he stacked up and caved a portion of the creek bank over on, after he took all their money, which was a nice sum of coin. He packed up all their supplies and guns and powder and lead and put out the campfire. Then he roped the horses together and swung into the saddle of the bay with the stocking feet. He headed back toward Nacogdoches, bloody scalps dangling. belt. Adolphus Stern paled at the sight of the scalps, but said nothing about it. Jamie handed him a list he'd prepared and then prowled the store, with the other customers getting quickly out of the way of the young man with the bloody buckskins and the scalps dangling from his wide belt. All except one man, that is. He was a swarthy-skinned man, wearing two pistols under his dress coat.
You got them all, McAllister?
Let's just say justice was served.
With the authority vested upon me by President Guerrero of Mexico, I now place you under arrest for murder.
Try it.
The man reached for a pistol, and Jamie's hand fell upon his wrist, seizing it in a grip as tight as any vise.
Don't be a fool. Think like a man. Those men callously and brutally stomped the life out of a helpless 5-month-old baby and tried to rape my wife. Now what would you have done?
The man's eyes lost some of their anger. A curious expression passed over his dark and handsome features. He nodded his head.
I too have a family. You did say your name was Curtis, did you not?
Jamie released the man's wrist and stepped back.
That I did, senor.
And you're from the country west of the Trinity, are you not?
That I am.
For a man only 5'4" tall, you have quite a grip, Curtis. Now, I regret that I have pressing matters outside of town that I must see to. Buenos dias, Señor Curtis, and adios.
Kate was working in the garden when she heard the horses approaching.
Oh, sweet God!
Kate ran for a rifle only a few feet away and grabbed it up. She lowered the rifle as she saw the Lone Rider's golden hair hanging to his shoulders. He was leading a half dozen heavily laden pack horses and driving a herd of magnificent-looking riding horses. She walked out of the garden and over to the cabin, enlarged by another room the past year. Her husband was atop a bay with stocking feet. She looked at the dried scalps tied to the bay's mane. The scalps did not surprise her. Jamie jumped from the saddle and grabbed her up in his arms, lifting her off her feet and kissing her lips. They held each other for a long time.
It's over?
For a time. Way more newbie got away. But he'll be back. I won't josh you about that.
Jamie looked out at the fields he could see. They'd been worked and planted.
Moses did this?
All of us worked, Jamie. Moses and the others would work the mornings in their fields, then work the afternoons in our fields.
And Titus and Robert?
No sign of them. But Moses said someone has been slipping about on our places at night, spying.
Just one person?
Several. They wear boots, Wells said.
They're playing a dangerous game.
Jamie, the scalps?
I'm keeping them. If I have to hunt men again, I'll tie them to my horse's mane or my long rifle as a warning to others who try to hurt us or take from us.
Kate knew that the topic of conversation was concluded. They both turned at the sound of an approaching horse. It was Moses and Jed.
Jed's grown. I sure haven't been gone that long.
Well, that's what you think. But yes, Jed's shooting up like a stalk of corn.
Liza and the twins and Sally and Wells and their kids soon joined the group, and they unloaded the supplies, Jamie dividing them equally. Afterwards, the men relaxed for a time, Jed among them, over cups of coffee.
These men skulking about at night. Tell me about them.
Half a dozen of them, at least. But they don't all come at once. Two this night, two others the next night, and so on. It's got me jumping.
Has anything been stolen?
Not a thing that I can see.
I don't know who they is. It's got me baffled. Like they're playing a game with us, but only they know the rules.
Have any of you spoken with the Indians?
They haven't been around. This time of year, they planting too.
Stay close to your cabins tonight. The rules of this game are about to change.
Hard Olmsted and John Jackson sat in Olmsted's fancy office in New Orleans and stared in silence at one another. The two teams of men they'd sent into the big thicket country were long overdue. And both men knew that meant only one thing. Jamie McAllister had struck again. Hart looked at a very rough drawing, not a very precise map of the big thicket country. It stretched for several hundred miles and was about as accurate as trying to count the fleas on a dog. Both men were dressed elegantly, but anyone with a knowing eye could tell they were nothing more than dressed-up white trash. Both men had been rebuked by everyone of quality in the whole city. Jim Bowie, a man who had made a fortune working with the pirate Jean Lafitte in the selling of slaves, would have nothing to do with Olmstead or Jackson. Despite his wild reputation, Bowie had done it all, from capturing and breaking wild horses to riding on the backs of alligators for fun. Bowie was a gentleman, and he knew trash when he saw it. But Olmstead and Jackson were now reasonably well-off men, and their gangs of brigands were large, roaming all over several states and territories slaving. Bowie was out of the city now, not expected to return anytime soon. He was in Mexico, down to Saltillo, capital of the state of Coahuila, a guest of Veramendi, the vice governor of San Antonio of Debar. Both of them were involved in some sort of land deal. Bowie was, according to rumors, also actively courting Veramendi's daughter, Ursula. Hart Olmstead hated Bowie, but concealed it rather well, for he was scared to death of the man. Most people with any sense were. Hart looked up from the crude map.
Titus couldn't find the cabins this trip?
Nah, he got everybody lost as a goose in those swamps. I tell you, Hart, you gotta see that place to believe it. It's the spookiest damn place I ever seen in all my life.
I'll see it. I'm putting together an outfit now. We're going into the big thicket country to settle this once and for all.
Waymar Newby's back! He's been hurt! His gang was wiped out by that McAllister person!
God damn it, where's Waymar?
Being attended to by the doctor. His left hand is crippled, and the doctor's digging around now for the arrow in his hip.
Waymar's face was shiny with the sweat of pain, but he was conscious and able to talk, the bloody arrowhead lying in a pan on a table by his bed. He elected not to tell Olmstead about the attempted rape of his daughter or the callous killing of his grandbaby.
McAllister ambushed us. He killed all the men and scalped them. There ain't nobody over yonder going to arrest him, Hart. The area is policed by Chief DeWally's Cherokees, and Jamie's done made friends with all of them. A man can't get through the big thicket from the east. There just ain't no way, except that known to but a few, and they ain't talking.
Waymar noticed that Hart was looking at his heavily bandaged hand.
It's ruined. I ain't got but scant use of a couple of fingers. I want to go back, Hart. I got me a score to settle with Jamie McAllister.
We're all going. I'm putting together supplies now. It'll be a couple of months before I'm ready. I've got me a man down in south of Texas who says he knows where Jamie and that whore daughter of mine live. Says he's got a personal score to settle with McAllister. Seems they had some trouble down in Galveston a few years back. His name is Bradford.
Wagons coming, Mr. Jamie. Three wagons.
White man?
Uh-huh. Prosperous looking, too. How'd they get through?
I don't know. They sure took a chance.
Mexico had recently forbidden any further colonization of Texas by Americans and was strictly enforcing the importation of slaves into the territory.
They're about 3 miles out now. I ain't never seen nothing but men of quality ride a horse the way the man in front does. And the women driving the first two wagons is beautiful.
Interesting.
Jamie had been sleeping outside for more than a week now, but there was no sign of those who were skulking about. Jamie decided to throw a saddle on a horse and ride out to meet the newcomers in the wagons. He'd find out they were not newcomers to him, only to the territory.
If we start to work in the morning, I believe we can get a crop in.
Oh, easily. Winters are very mild down here.
Jamie looked at Sam and Sarah, then at Swede and Hannah. The latter had two children, a boy 3 and a girl about 15 months old.
But why did you pull out of Kentucky?
It's a long story, Jamie, but I'll make it short. Olmstead and Jackson somehow found out I had been a Shawnee slave and wife for years. They rode all the way to Illinois to spread the story. Most people accepted my past, but many shunned me. If we had stayed, Swede would have eventually killed someone.
That I can understand, Hannah. Sam, how about you and Sarah?
Well, Caney died during a robbery. The Reverend Calloway and family moved away. And to tell the truth, both Sarah and me were getting restless. I hired a Western man to find you and report back to me. When he told us of this land, we both agreed that we just had to see it. I sold out and made a very tidy profit indeed. And here we are, Jamie.
And there are no other people in this world that I would rather see. But the Cherokees will surely report you to the Mexican government.
No, they won't, Kate. I used some of the profits to ensure that. The Cherokees are very intelligent people. They know the value of money.
Oh, I take it you've made Egg's acquaintance.
That man is anything but a fragile egg. That's the biggest Indian I have ever seen. Does he ever come around here?
Egg is everywhere at all times, Sarah.
Now, Jamie, really?
Oh, it's true. He has spies everywhere. They report to him. Nothing goes on that Egg doesn't know about.
So, tell us about yourself, Jamie.
Not much to tell, really, Swede.
Sam caught the quick look that passed between Moses and Wells. Sarah noticed that Kate and Liza and Sally suddenly got very busy sewing on the patchwork quilt they were making.
Out with it, my friend.
Jamie finished his cup of coffee and sat for a few seconds, staring into his cup. Then he began to speak, chronicling the years from the time they left Kentucky up to the present. He left nothing out. The four newcomers sat in silence after Jamie had finished. Three of them were shocked at the open admission of violence, and their faces showed that. Hannah smiled and winked at Jamie. She knew the warrior's way, and could understand from her years with the Shawnees why Jamie scalped all the men but one, and why he gave that man a decent burial and didn't mutilate him. That man had shown courage.
I certainly understand your rage, lad. It was horrible what happened to your child, but it was hardly civilized behavior on your part either.
It isn't a civilized time. And I believe that one must meet uncivilized behavior with uncivilized behavior. And that is the only way the robbers and rapists and brigands of the world will cease their evil deeds.
The summer passed amid a flurry of work and fun. A peddler came along in a big wagon and thought a trading post would do just fine located along the El Camino Real, the Royal Road. There were already a dozen or more cabins there along the Ayish Bayou, with others in various stages of construction. A Spanish mission had been there for more than 100 years, but had been abandoned back in the late 1770s when Spain evacuated all East Texas missions. The old walls were still there. It was settled by Anglos in about 1818 and called San Augustine. But now the town was growing. Jamie viewed it with mixed emotions.
Even if Mexico lets them stay, which is in some doubt, a town brings people. And for us, Kate, people mean trouble.
As Jamie spoke, Hart Olmsted, John Jackson, Titus Jefferson, Robert Washington, and a force some 50-odd men of extremely ill repute and breeding were leaving New Orleans, heading into the territory of Texas to find and kill Jamie Ian McAllister. Olmsted had found a man who said he could lead them through the southernmost part of the big thicket. They would resupply at the trading post of Beaumont, and then head north toward the tiny village of San Augustine. He heard that some whites had settled not too far from there in the swamps called the Big Thicket. The guide was a French trapper called LeBeau. LeBeau was not his real name. Louisiana had had warrants for his arrest for years, but he knew the bayous of South Louisiana and had family there. Even his family had finally wearied of his outlaw ways, and his own father had bid him adieu with an assload of buckshot. But it would be weeks before the mounted column ever got close to Jamie. And in the big thicket, life went on. The cabins of Sam and Sarah and Sweet and Hannah were built. It didn't take long with everybody working. The cabins were not nearly so grand as the one Sam and Sarah had left behind, but that didn't matter. They were once more close to Jamie and Kate. Since he didn't really own the land, Jamie gave part of his cleared land to Sam and Sweet. During the rather mild winter, they would start clearing more. The who and why of the night visitors was as yet unknown to Jamie. Whoever the visitors might be, they were not coming in from the east through the swamps, for Jamie had picked up their trail and followed it. They were coming in from the west. He lost the trail on the now more heavily traveled road a few miles from his cabin in the thicket. Kate had told the women privately that she was once more pregnant, but Jamie had not yet told Moses. He didn't want another lecture about how babies were made. One night in bed, Jamie put a big hand gently on Kate's stomach.
You think it's twins again, Kate?
I don't know, but I sure am getting big awfully fast. I told you, Jamie, triplets run on my mother's side of the family.
Good God, triplets! I'll have to add another room.
LeBeau was true to his word. He led the men over to the post at Beaumont, and there they resupplied for the trek north. but Hart was careful not to send but a few men in, and they went in one at a time over a period of several days. The Mexican government was really cracking down on Anglo's attempting to settle in Texas, and there had been more than a few armed conflicts between the Mexican army and Americans trying to settle. But Austin was helping to bring them in anyway, sometimes by very devious routes, and come they did. Fontaine had returned from a business trip. Well, actually, he was reporting back to Washington, to President Jackson, on the freedom movement by the Americans in Texas. And he'd noticed the men drifting in to buy supplies. Far too many supplies for one man. Fontaine commissioned one of his own men to haunt the post and keep tabs on how many men bought how much supplies. It didn't take Fontaine long to put it all together, and he sent one of his men to follow a rough-looking fellow who'd purchased far too much stuff. There's 50 or so men camped about 5 miles to the east, Captain. The aide used Fontaine's old army rank. And they're a rough-looking lot. I got in close and heard the names of Jackson and Olmsted.
Olmsted? Now, where have I heard that name before?
Then it came to him. Jamie McAllister had mentioned him with disdain several years back at the post where the bounty hunter tried to take him back to Kentucky. Fontaine turned to his man.
Get you some food and rest, then take the best mount in my remuda and ride like the wind. You know where Jamie McAllister settled?
Yes, Captain, just east of San Augustine, in the big thicket. Them thugs, they're here to do harm to the lad and his wife?
I believe so.
I don't need any rest, and it won't take me but a moment to change saddles. That's a good boy. Them are good folks who settled in there with him. Jamie had long anticipated the day when Hart Olmsted and John Jackson would find them and launch an attack against them. Deep in the swamps, miles from where he and Kate lived and farmed the land, he'd built a snug cabin and stocked it with blankets and firewood. He'd also built a false bottom in the floor and kept it stocked with guns and powder and balls. And he'd taken the women there many, many times until they had the route committed to memory. They could paddle there day or night. Fontaine's man rode hard, changing horses several times along the way. He galloped into Jamie's yard and jumped from the saddle.
McAllister!
Moses came around the corner, followed by Jamie, a rifle in his hand. Kate, heavy in her pregnancy, stepped into the doorway, armed with a rifle as well.
Fontaine sent me. Olmsted and Jackson have pulled out of Beaumont by now. They got about 50 men with them, and to a man, they're a vile, evil lot.
You come on into the cabin, sir. I have hot food and a bed. You're exhausted.
I'm begging your pardon, ma'am, but I'm too nasty to soil your home.
Well, then there's water right there to wash with, and I'm washing clothes now. You get yourself out of your clothes, wash up, wrap up in a blanket, and I'll fetch you some food.
If you don't have no objections to wearing clothes a black man's wore, I can have them here for you in 10 minutes. We're about the same size.
I don't hold with slavery, although many of my friends do. Does that make a difference to you?
Ne'er a bit. I'll be back in a moment.
Ellen Kathleen, blonde and blue-eyed, came walking out, carefully holding a big bowl of stew. Jamie Ian came along behind her with cornbread and a wooden mug for milk from the coolness of the well.
Thank you, children.
Sit down yonder under the dog tot where there's shade and eat.
Well, I'm much obliged.
I remember you now. I've met you. But I can't recall the name.
Bonham. I seen you whoop that trash Bradford that day at Smith's Post. Bradford's linked up with Olmsted. He's leading him here.
Eat, and then we'll talk.
Bonham fell to his food, and from the expression on his face, he was a happy man. Kate had turned into an excellent cook. When he was finished, he settled back and lit up a cigar.
Best food I've had many a moon, ma'am. Them Mexican peppers do give it just the right bite, don't they?
Jamie had brought out 2 mugs of coffee and set one down by Bonham.
You got a hiding place, Jamie?
How much time do you think I have, Bonham?
Oh, ample time, ample. It's nigh 100 miles to here. Then when they get here, they gotta find you. Find us.
Oh, it's not your fight.
Moses had returned with clean clothes. Wells and Sally and Liz had come over, and now Sam and Sarah and Sweet and Hannah made their appearance. Bonham looked at the men.
Can y'all fight?
When angered.
Well, then you better get angry. Because if you don't, in a few days, y'all gonna be dead.
The women were sent to the cabin in the swamps with enough food to last them for the duration. They didn't argue when Jamie told them to go. They just packed up, kissed their men, and went. The men, with Bonham staying despite the objections from Jamie, packed up what they could of the contents of the cabins hid the precious articles in the woods and made ready to defend their land and lives. Jamie tied his scalps onto the mane of his favorite, a stallion he called Buck, and he packed up a few supplies. Bonham was amused when he noticed the scalps. When Jamie McAllister went hunting, the man thought he meant business. Bonham did not have to ask what Jamie was going to do. He knew. Jamie was heading out to cut down the odds some. He swung into the saddle, his rifle in his hand. He had two pistols and holsters around his waist and four more in leather on the saddle. His short-barreled carbine was saddle-booted and his bow and quiver of arrows was slung around him.
They ought to be about a day away.
I'll see to things. Don't worry.
Thanks. Yeah!
Jamie stayed on game trails just inside the swampy edge of the thicket. He'd explored the thicket and knew it as well as any living man, except perhaps for the Indians who lived in it. By late afternoon, he smelled the smoke from fires, and with it, the odor of food being cooked. He picketed Buck on a good graze near water and began working his way to the edge of the enemy camp. He was a warrior and on a warrior's path. These men came for blood, and they'd have it, their own. Jamie worked in close on his belly.
Bradford says by noon tomorrow we'll be in McAllister's home territory. Dillman, you and Barnett ride out with Bradford before dawn and scout ahead. I'll give $500 in gold to the man who brings me Jamie Ian McAllister's head.
What about your daughter?
I have no daughter. That slut made her choice years ago. Kill her. Wipe them all out. They're nothing but lice and fleas.
That's right. They're all mixed up with niggers and Injuns. God only knows who's been breeding with what. We're doing the territory a favor when we destroy them.
Jamie could see Titus and Robert. He wondered what was going through their minds at Olmstead's words. He slowly worked away from the encampment and made his way back into the edge of the thicket. He would eat a bite or two and then rest. Tonight, he was going to be very busy. Bradford was a man who liked his privacy. He'd bedded down away from the others. He lit his pipe with a burning twig from the dying fire and leaned back against the fallen log, content in his mind.
Mara, I'm gonna be first in that clearing where that damn McAllister lives, and I'm gonna be the first to reach that bastard. I'm gonna kill him and cut off his head for Olmstead to see. I owe him for making a fool out of me down at Smith's Trading Post that time. And I'm gonna use McAllister's own damn axe to do the deed. And I know that axe is sharp. I've done my midnight creeping around there. McAllister keeps things neat and clean, ready to use it all.
You're right, Bradford. I keep all my blades sharp.
Jamie finished cutting Bradford's throat, and behind the fallen log, eased him down onto his blankets with one strong hand. He moved to the picket line and stood silent for a few moments, letting the horses smell him and see that he meant no harm. He'd already been there several times that evening. When the sentry was at one end, Jamie would be at the other, or in the middle. The horses were used to him now. He began working quickly and soundlessly. He cut partway through several dozen cinch straps, just enough so after a few miles of riding, they'd break. He picked up several dozen cockle burrs, and he worked them deep into as many saddle blankets as he could find. He mentally apologized to the horses for the discomfort he was about to cause them come the morning. When the sentry shift changed a few minutes after Jamie finished with the saddles, Jamie ruined the new guard's evening. He stretched the man out on the ground, silently followed another man into the timber, and watched him drop his pants and squat down. Jamie's arrow drove all the way through the man's head, the point exiting out the other side.
What the hell was that, Sam?
That's just less. He makes more goddamn goofy noises taking a crap than anybody I know.
The camp quieted down again, and Jamie took the man's hair and then flitted as silent as a shadow through the timber on the edge of the encampment. He'd already chosen his next kill. Then sudden movement caught his eyes. He froze and watched as John Jackson stood up and walked to the fire, adding more wood because the night was cool. It was too good an opportunity to pass up. It was true, taking Jackson in the center of his chest. Jackson fell forward, first on his knees, and then face down into the fire.
Now, what the hell was that?
Well, it ain't Les taking a crap.
Somebody tripped and fell in fire!
Rip my ass! He's got an arrow in him!
Indians! They all about us, boys!
Jamie turned and ran toward the safety of the thicket. Several miles from the camp, he rolled up in his blanket and fell asleep. In the morning, Jamie got into position long before the sky began to gray. The bodies of the four men had been wrapped in blankets and laid to one side for burial come first light. The camp began to stir, and as soon as men had swilled coffee, a few took shovels and began to dig. Jamie sat amid thick foliage, only his eyes moving. And as he had anticipated, the men were wary, and Olmsted had posted many guards. To try anything now would be foolish. Before leaving his hidden camp, Jamie had fixed up two arrows, attaching small bags of gunpowder just behind the arrowheads. Just as the men mounted up, he planned on dropping the arrows into the dying coals of the fire. With the already weakened cinch straps, the explosions would produce some very interesting results. Once the scalp bodies were committed to the earth, the crowd broke up and began packing, then moving to their horses. Jamie notched an arrow and stood up, concealed behind a tree. Two men made a half-hearted attempt at putting out the fires, then moved toward their saddled horses and mounted them. Jamie let his arrow fly, one to each fire pit. Riders went flying in all directions, and a few saddle cinches broke, adding to the confusion. Abel Jackson was tossed to the ground, and when he attempted to get up, he presented his big butt to Jamie. Abel started to grab himself. Jamie put another arrow into a man, straight into his chest. The next arrow went into Carl Olmsted's leg. Jamie jerked out his pistols and let the lead sing their death song. Then Jamie raced back into the thicket and kept on running until he reached his saddled horse. He knew none of the men would pursue him very deep into the dark and dangerous mysteries of the thicket. Several miles behind him, Olmsted and his men had just managed to get things under control. By this time, they'd figured out that they were being harassed not by Indians, but by Jamie. Hard Olmsted was angry to the core, his face mottled with rage. Olmsted's field surgeon for this expedition, a barber from New Orleans who usually stayed about half drunk most of the time, was busy with the wounded. Abel Jackson was forcibly held down while his buttock was sliced open and the arrowhead removed. Waymore Newby had retreated to cover and was keeping a good eye out for Jamie. He knew from experience just how dangerous the young man was. Hart Olmsted surveyed the damage done. To his mind, it was unbelievable that one young man could wreak such havoc. LeBeau approached him.
There's a doctor at Nagadoches. Some of the wounded will make it, a couple won't.
Hart assigned men to take the wounded into the town with orders to say they were wounded during an Indian attack. His force of 50-odd men had been cut to less than 40, and they still had a long way to go. Titus and Robert were scared, and they made no effort to hide that fear. Robert had known all along just how dangerous Jamie Ian McAllister was.
He can walk among wolves and panthers without being harmed. He can stand next to a tree, and you can't see him. And he knows every inch of the swamps. Well, he's as strong as any man I've seen. And worse, he don't know fear.
Hart Olmsted dismissed the talk as just so much scared babbling. But the man realized he had major problems. With Bradford gone, so went the location of Jamie's cabin and how to get to it. He'd seen paths and trails and even wagon ruts leading off to the east into the darkness of the thicket. But to follow each and every one of them would take weeks or months, and his men weren't at all anxious to enter that foreboding-looking swamp. Tell the truth, neither was he. Olmsted gathered his sons, Ernest, Patrick, and Jubal, to him. Carl had gone with the wounded to Nacogdoches.
We know he lives just east of that settlement called San Augustine. We'll concentrate our search there. Mount up. We're pulling out.
If Hard Olmsted had possessed any sense from the outset, he would have left Jamie alone. Further evidence of how arrogant and short-sighted he was came when he didn't pull the column away from the edge of the thicket and move him over to the western mile or so. He doggedly maintained a northerly route at the edge of the dark swamps. Just about the only smart thing that Hard Olmsted did was not to lead the column of men. He stayed in the middle of the column, surrounded and therefore protected by his own men from shot or arrow that might come from the swamps that lay silent and deadly to his right. After several miles had passed uneventfully, the men began to relax. Not a one of them had taken the time to inspect the belly cinches on the horses, even after a few had broken back at the encampment. Cinch straps broke every now and then. None of them had any reason to suspect that Jamie McAllister had anything to do with it. Jamie watched the column of horsemen advance. His long hair was braided and his head covered with a brown bandana. His face was deliberately streaked with mud and the natural green from leaves. His buckskin blended in with his surroundings. Jamie and the swamps were as one. He brought two rifles, and now he used them.
It's McAllister.
Jamie was off and running to the north, toward where he had left his horse some distance away. He paused once to charge his rifles, and then continued running, staying in the thicket, weaving along the game trail. He reached his next chosen ambush spot and waited. Then he mounted up and rode out of the thicket and into a clearing. He looked south. The column of men had not stopped to bury their dead. They were riding straight toward him. Jamie lifted his rifle and taunted those to the south. Then he turned the stallion's head to the north and, staying in the open, rode away slowly. Hard Olmsted did exactly what Jamie hoped he would do.
After him, man!
Jamie smiled and stopped, turning around to face the galloping charge. Cinch straps began breaking and men were tossed to the ground, many of them caught beneath the hooves of the horses galloping behind them. Olmsted hit the ground hard, as did his sons. LeBeau, realizing what was happening, felt his saddle began to slide and threw himself to one side, landing hard, losing his rifle, but avoiding the deadly hooves of those horses behind him. LeBeau knew one thing. He was through with this hunt.
Yeah!
Jamie touched his heels to his horse and once more disappeared into the thicket. He rode south for a few hundred yards until he was opposite the scene of confusion. Leaping from the saddle, he fired into the tangled knot of addled men, emptying his rifles and pistols. And Jamie was once more into the saddle, riding hard to the north. 2 miles from the costly ambush, Jamie left the edge of the swamps and rode straight west for a couple of miles. Squatting in the timber, this time on the west side of the trail, he charged his empty weapons and waited. Jamie ate a biscuit, took a drink from his water jug. He was a long way from being through with Hard Olmsted and his rapidly dwindling army of thugs and brigands. A few miles south, Hard Olmsted, holding a bloody rag to a nasty cut on his head, surveyed his situation, and it wasn't good. He had about 20 men left able to ride and fight, and half a dozen of those were hurt. LeBeau had repaired his cinch strap and ridden off without saying a word. 6 others had exchanged silent glances and followed him. Hart walked over to Waymore Newby.
Are you with me, man?
I'm staying. I want McAllister nearby as bad as you do.
Hart nodded and walked to his sons. All of them were cut and bruised from their impacting with the ground at great speeds. Jubal had a wild and unstable look in his eyes. He was a whore master and a slaver in New Orleans, making a great deal of money. But he would never be content till he stood over Jamie's body and spat on the corpse.
We'll move west a few miles away from that accursed swamp. Alan says there's another trail over yonder. Saddle up, we're riding.
Jamie waited in the deep timber. He had chosen well. His place was thick with underbrush, so thick and tangled, if any tried to come in after him, they would have had to done so on foot. And this tangle of trees and vines and thorny brush ran for several miles deep and a dozen miles north to south. J- Jamie's horse is picketed far back in the timber on graze and ample water. Jamie waited, and it was not a long wait. Jamie smiled. The column was, as before, formed to protect Hart Olmsted and his sons. The men were riding in sort of a loosely formed W with the Olmsted family in the protected middle. Jamie loosed an arrow and took a man down. Jamie instantly changed positions, notching another arrow as he moved. Guns crashed and sent balls into the brush he had just vacated. Jamie let fly another arrow. The arrow pinned a man's arm to his side. Jamie moved swiftly, this time on his belly, working his way through the choking underbrush, moving like a huge, deadly serpent.
Get in there and kill the bastard!
A half dozen men charged their horses into the timber and were stopped cold by the impenetrable growth.
Retreat!
The five other riders, fear clouding their faces, raced back in the clearing. Hart and the others had disappeared behind a rise, for this country was gently rolling hills. Again, Jamie changed position, on his way picking up the fallen man's rifle and powder horn and ball and patch pouch. The rifle was a good one, nearly new and a heavy caliber. Jamie recharged the musket and slipped to the edge of the timber. He didn't have to worry about anyone coming up behind him, or really anyone coming up on either side of his position. If Hart tried anything, it would have been a frontal assault. The crest of the ridge was about 100 yards away, an easy shot for Jamie if a target ever presented itself. But Hart's men were being very wary, and Jamie saw the dark humor in that and allowed himself a cold, thin smile. He waited.
If we ride in any direction, McAllister will just pick us off one at a time. If we stay here until dark...
My woman is French, deep into voodoo, and she says that Jamie McAllister has spirits all around him all the time. Good spirits and bad spirits. She warned me this mission would fail.
What else did she say about him?
That McAllister can take the form of different animals. Wolves, panthers, and the like.
Bullshit!
That does it. I'm gone.
I'm with you.
There ain't no amount of money worth dying for, Hart. And it wouldn't be wise to try and stop us.
The spooked quartet walked to their horses and booted their rifles. Then they found sticks and tied rags to the ends of them and mounted up.
McAllister, these four's us leaving. We ain't joshing none. We are pulling out and you ain't never gonna see us again. We got sticks in our hands and rags are tied to the end. Our rifles is booted. We're heading south. Please let us go.
Go and be damned. I hope he shoots you all.
He won't. Because it got something that don't none of us have.
And what might that be?
Honor.
Four men rode out slowly and headed south, each of them expecting a bullet in the back. Jamie let him go. Hart looked around him. He couldn't spot Titus or Robert. In fact, the two had stolen some supplies during the confusion and slipped away. They wanted no more of Jamie McAllister or of Hart Olmsted. Ernest Olmsted walked up to his father.
Pa, it's over. We gotta stay alive for the sake of our wounded Ken Westy here. McAllister's done cut our force down to nothing. Half of them that stayed is hurt. He's got us.
Boy, are you suggesting that we...
I'm suggesting that we live, Pa. I'm saying that we call a truce with McAllister and ride on out of here over to Nacogdoches. When Carl and the others is able to ride, we head back to New Orleans and get on with our living. Look, Pa, I hate Jamie McAllister, but I love life more. We got a good thing going in New Orleans. Are we going to throw all that away for one man?
Patrick Olmsted had slipped up and was listening.
Ernest is right, Paul. More than half the men we got left is talking about pulling out. If it was put to a vote, this fight would end right here and now.
Hart Olmsted's shoulders sagged. He stared down at his filthy hands.
Fix a stick with a white rag. Tell McAllister it's over as far as I'm concerned.
Jubal's eyes grew wide and angry.
You ain't talking for me, Pa. Not now, not never. Not for me and not for Abel Jackson. Me and him swore a blood oath long time ago.
Jubal paled as he slowly turned. Rifles and pistols were pointed at him. Ernest took Jubal's pistols and rifle.
Just stand easy, brother. This here is done.
Hart took the stick with the torn shirt on it and waved it above the ridgeline.
McAllister, I know you ain't gonna answer me, so just listen. This is Hart Olmstead talking. It's over, boy, you hear me? It's over. But I can't talk for my youngest, Jubal, nor for Abel Jackson. But for me and the rest of mine, you and Kate live your lives. You'll not see me again. Ernest has got Jubal at gunpoint, and he'll be that away till we're long gone. The man is heading south, and me and mine is heading over to the settlement to fetch the wounded back. You'll not see me again, McAllister. Not ever.
Jamie sensed the man was telling the truth.
All right, right on.
McAllister, this here's Waymore Newby. I'll be riding with Olmstead. You've seen the last of me.
Jamie most definitely did not believe that, but he let it go.
Right on, Newby.
Jamie watched the men leave. Hart and his sons, with Waymore tagging along, rode toward Nacogdoches. The rest of the men headed south. He waited until they were out of sight and then fetched his horse. Wearily, climbed into the saddle, rode east. Jamie told his family and friends what had happened once, and then would speak no more of it. He learned that three of those taken to the doctor at Nacogdoches had died, one before reaching there, and that Hart Olmstead and sons were gone back to Louisiana, Waymore Newby with them. Jamie settled down to the chores of everyday living on a rapidly growing farm. Young as he was, Jamie had to sit down to stop the dizziness in his head when Liza came out onto the newly built porch one day with the news. Jamie was the father of triplets, Matthew, Megan, and Morgan. Moses put an arm around Jamie's shoulders.
Boy, this has got to stop.
Jamie numbly nodded his head.
What are you, 21 or 22 years old, and already the father of seven?
Seven.
Seven? Son, when Kate allows you close enough to her to make a difference again, which I hope won't be for a couple of years, go jump in the creek first, will you?
Jamie stood up.
Liza, can I see Kate and the babies?
Oh, yes, but only for a brief time.
How'd it go, love?
Very bad. I don't think she should have any more children, and Sarah agrees.
What does Kate say?
Oh, she says that's nonsense. She says she wants 9 children. Moses, Jamie and Kate are not much more than children themselves. What are they gonna do?
Kate's as hard-headed as Jamie, and in her own way, just as strong.
That don't answer my question.
What do you want me to do, sleep between them?
Moses, you're terrible.
The residents of Big Thicket got news from time to time of the growing unrest in the world outside their own, but they were largely unaware of the big picture. Mexico's centralist government, under the cruel and dictatorial Anastasio Bustamante, moved to crush any rebellion the free-spirited Texans might be dreaming up. Bustamante passed a law that ordered the military occupation of Texas with convict soldiers who were to remain on the land when their enlistment was up, and the law also stopped any further immigration of Americans into Texas. John Bradburn, an American mercenary colonel in the Mexican army, took over the garrison in Anahuac. He threatened to abolish the town of Liberty and seize the American settlers' land. About 150 Texas colonists went on the march toward Liberty to rescue the settlers that Colonel Bradburn had jailed. A battle ensued between Texas colonists and Mexican troops near the mouth of the Brazos River. Both sides took casualties, but the Mexicans eventually threw away their weapons and ran for their lives. In October of 1832, a group of Texans held a convention in San Felipe. It was to be the first of many. William Wharton delivered a stormy speech demanding absolute independence from Mexico. He tried to get elected president of the convention, but Stephen Austin, a cooler head, defeated him. The delegates wrote a petition and approved its delivery to Mexico. The petition's main points demanded separation from the state of Coahuila and full Mexican statehood for Texas.
But the petition never reached Mexico City, probably due to the bitter civil war raging in that country. In January of 1833, General Antonio Lopez de Santa Anna succeeded in driving Anastasio Bustamante from the office of President of Mexico. The Texans were excited at the news and immediately called for a new convention to be held in San Felipe in April of 33. It was during this time of struggle that Sam Houston crossed the Red River and entered Nacogdoches, then the most populated and largest American town in Texas. He had come, at President Jackson's request, to meet with the Comanches in an effort to bring peace between them and the white settlers. The negotiations amounted to nothing other than to stir Mexico's resentment over the American president's interference in its affairs. When Houston returned to Nacogdoches, he found that the citizens there had placed his name and nomination to be their delegate at the upcoming convention in April in San Felipe. He accepted and helped draft the first constitution for the state, and the delegates asked Stephen Austin to take the petition and the new constitution to Mexico and meet with Santa Anna. Austin, 39, was not in good health, but he agreed to go. That trip got him arrested in Mexico and cost him 8 months in a Mexican calaboose. After 3 months in solitary confinement, he was moved to better quarters and could write letters, telling his friends and family where he was and pleading for the Texans to remain calm and take no violent actions. The Texans agreed to that. Austin would not return home for nearly 2 years. He was no longer under arrest after 8 months, but he wasn't allowed to leave Mexico. Like Austin, Houston asked for calm and restraint. Houston, a lifelong atheist, joined the Catholic Church, as was required of all landowners, and took the name of Don Samuel Pablo Houston. Before doing all this, he divorced his wife, Eliza. Also during this period of time, Sam Houston's good friend Jim Bowie, who had moved to Texas, lost his wife Ursula and 2 children to cholera. For months, he all but slept in a barrel of whiskey, and his health deteriorated badly. Over in the swamps and cleared fields of the Big Thicket, life went on, with Jamie and Kate and family snug in their cabin, although it would be inaccurate to call the now 6-room structure a cabin. Kate had another child early in 34, a girl they named Jolene. In March of 1834, just as Jamie and the others were sharpening their axes and getting ready their plows and teams for the spring planting, Bonham sent him word. Some rascally-looking men had been making inquiries about Jamie down at Beaumont in the saloons that catered to the less desirable clientele. One of them was named Saxon.
When will it end, Jamie?
When they're all dead, I reckon, Kate.
Jamie stood up, treetop tall, and with shoulders so broad he had to turn sideways to go through many doorways, and leaned down and kissed his wife.
I've already arranged for the Nunez boys to get the land ready and to plant if I'm not back.
The Juan Nunez family lived right on the edge of the thicket, and Jamie and Kate had become friends with them. During the winter, Juan and his wife Maria became seriously ill, and Jamie and Kate nursed them back to health and saw to the needs of their children during their illness. Jamie and Kate had made friends for life. Kate handed Jamie a packet of food and waited until he had looked in on all the children, standing for a time looking down at the sleeping Jolene. Jamie and Kate walked out to where Sam and Sarah, Sweet and Hannah, Moses and Liza, and Wells and Sally had gathered. He bid them all good night and goodbye for the present and mounted his horse, the mane now holding more than 2 dozen dried scalps.